Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight. The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So today we've been doing our education segments, looking at special education. And, you know, I go back to my days in college. Initially started off as an elementary ed teacher. You know, that was my major. It's what I wanted to do. And then, you know, thrown into that fire, the first teaching experience, getting into the classroom and seeing the effects of mainstreaming on the school that I was, it just kind of sent me going, I don't know that I can do this. Class size is getting bigger, all the disruptions, all of that stuff, which is why I thought it'd be a great opportunity to reach out to someone who is actively teaching and also has a special needs child of her own. Bianca Tennis is a special ed teacher there in New York in the K-2 program. Bianca, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I go back to my experience, and I think a lot of this stuff you take from your own experience. And I remember back in the 80s, the early kind of pushing kids with special needs into regular classrooms and the pain and the disruption. Things have gotten better, but I see things going kind of backwards.
Well, I think we've developed probably since the 80s a continuum of classrooms and settings for children. So we have all kinds of different settings, and there's a lot of flexibility. Children, we usually don't push them into a general ed class or an inclusion class until they're ready. But what I have found since the implementation of the Common Core and high-stakes testing, a lot of kids that were doing very well and being very successful in an inclusion class where you had, say, 17 children who did not have an IEP or a learning disability, and then perhaps five or six children with an IEP, that's becoming less and less of a possibility for many children because the curriculum and the standards have become so inappropriately difficult that it becomes very challenging for teachers to differentiate and meet the needs of those students. So inclusion, those kinds of programs are becoming more difficult to maintain.
You know, because, you know, as I've been saying throughout the day today, we know someone who they have a special needs child and they don't think their kids should be taking the PSSA, the standardized test at the end of the year, because they just don't think that there's any way that they're ever going to pass it. And the message that it sends to that kid of being a failure only makes, in their opinion, things worse.
Well, I can tell you, this year I'm teaching a K-1-2 self-contained class, but in the past I've taught fourth grade and fifth grade. And administering these tests to a child that you know is going to fail is a horrible, horrible situation. Many of these children have made tremendous progress over the school year. They're feeling good about themselves, and then testing season rolls around, and all of a sudden they're getting this intense message of failure. And a lot of these children, they really internalize that message of failure. And we work so hard to build their confidence and their self-esteem, and that's really what I didn't want to see happening to my own child, which is why I tried opting that about 3 years ago. So it's damaging, and it's absolutely inappropriate. And with testing, we're seeing it trickle down to kindergarten, and I know there's talk of testing in pre-K in the coming year.
Jeez. Well, why don't we just test them in the womb?
Exactly. I mean, it's we laugh about it because it's ridiculous. But those of us who are working with these children really see how damaging it is, and that's one of the biggest frustrations is we have people making policy and decisions that have never worked with children.
I mean, because the reality is you're never going to, and I remember because of No Child Left Behind, there was supposed to be 100% of all the children were supposed to pass this test. And look, you can't get 100% of the people on a sunny day to say the sky's blue, let alone pass some of these tests. And given the different ability levels of all the kids in this scenario, I just think what we've done is we're moving to this assembly-lined education model that all kids don't learn the same and all kids aren't going to get it the first time around. I struggle with where we're going.
Absolutely. And, some children are very bright and are not good test takers. And what happens is we diminish the focus on their strengths. So you might have some children who are amazing artists, who are very gifted writers. And because they can't fit their talents and their strengths into this little box, they're being told that they're not good enough, that what they bring to the table is not what we're looking for. And it's just a very dangerous message to give to children because, like I said, they really do internalize it and it stays with them. There's a lot of studies that show, especially for children who are very creative, if you don't give them an outlet for that, they tend to become underachievers. And going into high school, they have a higher rate of dropout. So there are all of these unintended consequences to what we're doing. And I hope that politicians and policymakers are really starting to hear that.
Now, in your career, as you've seen this, I'm sure you've seen some really just incredible changes as you know, we continue to defund education and then ask for teachers to do more and schools to do more and take on more responsibility, especially with high-risk students and students in high-poverty areas.
Absolutely. And I can speak to what's happening in New York, and I know it's happening around the country in different forms, but we have these school takeovers, where when the school is not performing based on test scores, they're given a year to turn around, sometimes 2 years, and they're basically told turn around or your school will go into something called receivership, where a private entity will come in and take over the school. And it's really, it's not based on any kind of research or evidence. It's a complete setup for failure. And for children with disabilities, I mean, it damages all the students, but especially the children who struggle, because now the pressure to perform on these tests is even greater. And I can't even imagine that pressure, perform or your school will be closed, because kids are smart. And even if we're not telling them directly, they pick up on it.
Well, I know, to highlight that, the year we began opting our kids out of the high stakes tests, my oldest daughter was in fifth grade and she was play teaching with her younger brother and sister. And she was, you know, basically going on saying, if you don't pass this test, they're going to take money from the school. They're going to close the school down. And it was, you're going, what? Where'd that come from?
They're smart. They pick up on things, you know, and that's, I've heard from policymakers, well, it's the teachers. If they just protected the children from it, or if the pressure is coming from the teachers, and nothing could be farther from the truth. Every educator I know works very hard to protect their students from the external pressures, but they're still there. You know, when our kids only have 20 minutes of recess, when they're being told from the fourth day of school, we're behind, we have to catch up, we have so much to do, they feel it. It's not a natural way for children to learn. It's based on this bizarre adult notion of what's going to make education better.
See, I've often believed, Bianca, that what we need to be doing is we need to make the school days much longer. We need to make the school year much longer. And we need to have less time of grill and drill and much more time of play and experiential learning and getting your hands dirty and playing with worms and doing all of those things that, you know, we want kids to learn at their pace. And maybe even, you know, be doing something radical like doing away with this whole notion of you're going to go on to second grade and third grade. Maybe kids will move along at their pace.
You know, I think there's a lot to be said for that. You know, experiential learning is so important, and especially when we talk about poverty. You know, people talk about the achievement gap, and in that, a lot of times we see a vocabulary gap and a gap in different experiences. And a lot of these curriculum makers and textbook writers, they try and produce these programs that supposedly will increase a child's vocabulary. And, you know, you can do that, but there is no better teacher than actual experience. And I think when we talk about these standards as, you know, the miracle cure, what we need to be doing is getting kids into museums, getting them to concerts, getting them to parks and botanical gardens and creating these really rich experiences for them. And before we start to talk about tests, we really need to make sure that every child is having a really rich learning experience and environment with a lot of opportunity to play and have social interaction and problem solve on their own. And we don't have that. That costs money.
That's the thing. I mean, we're in the midst of the Hunger Games. Here in Pennsylvania, we had a governor for 4 years, and thank goodness he's gone. But for 4 years, gutted $1 billion a year out of public education, laid off some 30,000 education professionals across the Commonwealth, and then expected miraculous results with fewer teachers, less resources. In Philadelphia, they don't even have nurses or librarians in half of the schools. And they expect miracles to happen out of, and I know you can't throw money at the problem, but if you don't have any and there's snow coming in your roof, something's got to give, right?
Yeah, and you know, when people say, well, it's not something we can solve with money, you know, that always gets me. Because they say, first, let's make a list. Let's see how much it costs to make sure every school has a librarian, a fully stocked, functioning library, adequate social workers, psychologists, programs to enable all parents to come to school for parent-teacher conferences, whether it's vouchers for taxis or transportation. You know, let's make sure we have field trips and wraparound services and before school and after school help. Let's make sure we have all those things. Let's see what it costs. Let's make sure every school has that, and then let's talk about money. You know, because it's a really flawed argument. And I think part of the problem is how we fund our schools in this country. You know, we are one of the only developed nations where affluent, wealthy schools have more funding and more resources than poor schools. You know, it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. And that's no more apparent than here in Pennsylvania, where we don't really have a funding formula. It's basically based on property taxes. So obviously wealthier areas are going to have a much better tax base than poorer urban areas and even some of the rural areas. So you then have this complete, you know, lopsided education system. And in the special education world, much, much more lopsided when you're looking at the kind of resources that that poorer areas don't have that the wealthier areas do.
And, you know, that is really, to me, one of the most upsetting parts of all this is that, you know, especially as a parent of a child with special needs, that your zip code really does determine the level of services your child is going to receive. Because a lot of these services are not reimbursed with federal dollars. So there's a real incentive to provide as little as possible. You know, and I have to say, the schools want to do the best they can. They're working with, you know, they're working with nothing. And it really is the Hunger Games and it's survival. And every child with this, every child, regardless of whether or not they have an IEP and they have special needs, deserves an appropriate education.
No.
The children who learn differently when you don't give them the services they need, when we don't start when they're young, we're really putting them at a disservice for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, but that's not profitable,
and they don't get
Bianca.
A do-over with their education.
That's not profitable. We can't put cash in the wealth class's pockets with that kind of thinking.
Nope.
And that's what's sad about this.
I'm sorry, say that again?
And that's what's sad about this whole thing. It all comes down to this move towards privatization, and that's what's frustrating to me.
Absolutely, and what I find really disgusting is the narrative that a lot of these groups that are really pro-reform into the privatization movement, they're putting out this idea that this is all supposed to really close the achievement gap, help students in poverty, help students with disabilities, help students of color. And the fact is, at least here in New York, since the implementation of Common Core testing and the Common Core, the rate of failure for economically disadvantaged students, English language learners, special education students, students of color, the rate of failure has really increased extremely disproportionately than their economically advantaged white counterparts. So we are really hurting the most vulnerable students. And those numbers, nobody wants to talk about them. I don't see them in the headlines in the newspaper, which is very frustrating because to me, that's the story.
Yeah.
You know, that this is all built on lies.
No, you're right. And where you have the schools that are struggling, you have the schools that have the most problems outside of the school, as well as some of the problems inside the school that I would say start a lot with the funding. Let me ask you about you personally. I mean, I understand in New York that kids in some special needs programs are kind of out of this test, out of the testing regime. Am I getting that right?
Are out of it in terms of, you mean they don't have to take the test?
Right. Which I would think
a very, very small percentage of students qualify for what we call an alternate assessment, and it's a very stringent criteria. It's essentially for students who are severely disabled. And just to put that into context, there are students who are not eligible for the alternate assessment who have to blink their answers. You know, this is something that school districts are really discouraged from giving to students, and there is a cap to how many students the school district can give the alternate assessment. So the majority of students with disabilities are taking these tests, although I have to say, thankfully, more and more and more opting out, and we expect a tsunami of opt-outs next year. We think this is just going to continue until we take back our public schools
right.
And New York State gets it right. But as a special ed teacher, I can tell you, fifth graders in New York State sit for 3 hours of testing 3 days in a row, two times, so that's 18 hours of testing.
Wow.
And if they happen to be students with a disability who is also an English language learner, they take additional tests.
And if
so
you can't sit,
that's criminal to me.
And it's criminal. Well, what if you can't sit for 3 hours? What if you've got a kid who's got severe behavioral problems, severe problems that they're just not going to sit for 3 hours? It's just never going to happen. That's an expectation well out of this world.
All the time. And you know what's ridiculous is that test score is supposedly giving useful information. So that's the real fallacy here. You know, that test score is meaningless. It hurts the child. It hurts the teacher. And yet there are so many people who want to put stock in that score. And as a parent of a child with a disability, I was extremely frustrated when I first started down this road. In the beginning, I was told I could not opt my son out. He legally required to take it. I would have to keep him home from 12 days of school. I mean, it was really ridiculous and very eye-opening. But I called a number of disability rights advocacy groups, and I was stunned and just disgusted by what I heard. Many of them said, no, we believe in this testing. This testing is necessary to shine a bright light. That was their word, bright light. We need to shine a bright light on the inequalities. If we don't have these tests, students with disabilities will be stuck in basements again. And I kept saying to them, but what about the individual child who's being hurt, who's crying, pulling their hair out? And the response I received several times from several different groups was, we're really concerned about this issue at the policy level. This is not about the individual child.
Wow.
So that's kind of what we're dealing with.
Yeah, but sadly, I mean, you know, as someone who wasn't thrilled with the idea of absolute mainstreaming that I was seeing going on as a college student back in the 80s, I also don't want things going back to where the people are stuck in the basement or sent to special schools who knows where, or even institutionalized. I think that's the wrong road to go.
Well, I think that we've come a long way, and I'm not sure that this testing is what would prevent that from ever happening. I think that we've come a long way. Parents are a lot more savvy. Parents are great advocates for their children now. And the IEP is a really powerful document. And students with disabilities have protection in their individual education plans. And as long as we make those really very well thought out, strong documents, those are the best protection, because those are your civil rights. If you violate a child's IEP, you're violating their civil rights. As special education teachers and parents of students with disabilities, we really have to fight for that IEP. We have to educate each other. And that's really what will protect our children.
Yeah, as long as it's a public school, correct?
Absolutely. Private school is a whole other can of worms.
Yeah, you see, we continue down the privatization road to where everything's a charter or a parochial school or a private school. Then all of that stuff's out the window, the IEPs and all that out the window, right?
Yeah, they don't even have to let you in. I mean, I know that, at least in New York, Governor Cuomo came up with, he called it anti-creaming legislation, that would supposedly prevent charter schools from only accepting the top students, from dismissing special education students. A lot of charter schools in New York have very high suspension rates. But, you know, that would require monitoring, which takes money, which I don't see happening.
Yeah,
so when we talk about charter schools, they're selective. They are not beholden to a child's rights as they're outlined in their IEP in the same way other schools are. It's really public schools. That's the beautiful thing about them. Our doors are open to everyone.
Yeah. So last question I've got for you, Bianca. How's your child doing in all of this?
He's doing great. He has an amazing teacher. This is his second year with her, and he's making progress. He's happy. He loves school, he's confident, and he has never taken one of these tests, and I plan to keep it that way.
Good for you. Bianca Tanis, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Thanks so much, and keep it up. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks. Take care.
Really great talking with you. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.